Israel is not alone in having a defence industry. Israel is not alone in exporting weapons. But what distinguishes Israel from other countries is the centrality of Palestinian dispossession to its national identity. So what is it about that dispossession that makes Palestinians a laboratory for the export of oppression?
You're right. There are a lot of countries that have an arms industry. The US is the world's biggest arms industry. It's the 40% of the world's weapons are sold by our wonderful dear friend Washington. And they sell to pretty much anybody, dictatorships, democracies. But the difference with Israel is that it has a permanent occupied people in its backyard and has done so for essentially 56 years since 1967 and 75 years since 1948. Of a population which is occupied and essentially allowed, based on Israeli thinking, to be controlled. And over that period, both before the digital revolution and in the current era, there is a massive amount of tools and technologies that Israel is using. So in the modern era, we're talking about spyware, so-called smart walls, facial recognition, biometric data, all those kinds of ways that Israel does 24/7 to manage the occupation, to manage Palestinians. And I use the term manage, obviously, advisedly, to control Palestinians. And it's incredibly effective. And I use that term again advisedly. It's effective because Israel has found a way to not just maintain an occupation, but to make it seemingly incredibly popular. Now, on the face of it, that might not be popular in this room. And you might think if, for example, you look at the UN votes on this question, you have pretty much the entire world on one side. And the other side is US, Australia, bless us, Israel, Nauru, Micronesia and Palau. So on the face of it, it seems like, God, the whole world's against Israel. But actually, that's not the reality at all. They're against it maybe at the UN, but in practice, so many of those nations are so desperate and keen to get Israeli technology themselves to surveil and repress their own peoples. And the fact that Israel tests those technologies on Palestinians, its so-called battle test, that's the marketing tool, and that's how they sell it. And it works.
Okay, you say in the book that one can't overstate the significance of defense exports to the Israeli economy today, and you quote one expert who talks about we moved away from oranges to hand grenades. So that suggests a process. So I wonder if you could talk through that. Was Israel exporting repression from the Nakba in 1948, or was it something that developed later? And if it developed later, what were the milestones of that development?
I mean, you can't make much money from oranges, frankly. And Israel, fairly soon after its birth in 1948, started developing a domestic arms industry, which initially obviously was to, in its view, protect its own population, and even then, repress Palestinians. But pretty much from the 50s, so very soon after Israel's birth, there was a huge expansion of the Israeli defense industry to the point where they started selling and promoting their so-called defense experience to the world. This hugely accelerated after 1967, the Six-Day War. And very soon after that, Israel was clearly promoting itself as saying, we are controlling a Palestinian population in our backyard. We can teach you, other nations of the world, how to do the same thing to your population. So in the 60s and particularly in the 70s and onwards until this day, as I show in the book, there's at least 130 countries around the world that Israel has sold defense equipment to, so the majority of nations in the world. And this is everything, I mean, it's virtually impossible to find a horrible regime that Israel has not sold it to. So let me give you a bit of a taste. Everyone from Chile under Pinochet in the 70s to the Guatemalan regime whilst committing genocide in the 80s to Rwanda during the genocide in the 90s to Myanmar in the last years when it's committing genocide against the Rohingya Muslim population. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. So on the face of it, you would think this is morally outrageous. How has this continued to happen? The arms industry, obviously, by definition, is amoral with everyone. It's the most corrupt industry in the world alongside the drug industry It's worth trillions of dollars a year globally. Israel's now the 10th biggest arms dealer in the world. And in some ways, all those years of experience occupying Palestinians is what other nations wanted to copy. So for example, you have in the 70s and 80s, some of the Latin American dirty wars, Honduras, Colombia, Guatemala, the list goes on. They openly were calling for Israeli assistance. And I've kept in the book various quotes from Israeli officials and local officials in those nations saying, we want to get a bit of, I mean, I'm paraphrasing, we want to get a bit of what Israel's doing in Palestine for us, because it's seen as being successful. And I use that term, obviously, advisedly, what successful means, but the occupation was being exported. And very soon Israel realized, and this was a bipartisan issue, it didn't really matter if it was Labor or the Likud in power in Israel, it didn't make a damn bit of difference. This was a huge money earner. And Israel could be, and I see this in the modern era, as Israel's best insurance policy, in a way, because despite the fact that the political headwinds may well shift at some point in the coming years and decades, when you have so many nations around the world that are buying your defense equipment and want it and need it and are demanding it, are you likely to be very critical of Israel when it matters? You're not. And when Israel, for example, is now selling in the modern age the most sophisticated spyware and so-called smart walls, you know, the fear, you know, one of the reasons I wrote the book, apart from being a journalist and wanting to do an investigation into this issue, was almost as a warning to say that we are already, in 2023, we have more refugees in the world at any time since World War II, and that number is soaring. And what I fear is as many, many nations, in Western nations in the coming decades, will have to face growing climate crisis, refugees, resource wars, refugees, they're going to have to make a pretty clear choice, including us here in Australia. Do we choose to build higher walls, metaphorically or literally, or do we welcome people in? And I think most people in this room know what is more likely to happen in many nations. And Israeli surveillance tech and repressive tech is a key part of a lot of nations already today, infrastructure of keeping people out. And so the history of the occupation of Palestine, which as I said, and this is one of also what I wanted to discuss in the book, was that most conflicts in the world are geographically based in that country. So I spent a lot of time in the last two decades reporting on the war in Afghanistan or the drug war in Latin and South America, and those horrific conflicts, there's no minimizing that, but they're mostly based in those areas, within those borders. The occupation of Palestine is now exported around the world. So what's happening in Palestine does not stay there. It ends up in a range of other places around the world, including here. There is a real sense that Australia today is buying Israeli hacking tools, a company called Cellebrite. Most people might not have heard of it. Doesn't get much attention in the press. It's basically a tool that allows authorities to hack your phone, Android or iPhone. And it's used by virtually every government department in Australia, and it's used by Services Australia against welfare recipients. I'd like to think that would outrage people. Since we're writing about this in the last sort of month or so, since the book came out, I've been speaking about this in the press as much as I can, sort of almost hoping, stupidly, that someone might get upset about it and say, sorry, hang on, why are all these government departments using sophisticated Israeli hacking tools that are also, by the way, sold to the most repressive regimes in the world, Russia, China, Belarus, and others. And it's mostly crickets.
So Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, organizations within Israel have described Israel as an apartheid state. But a lot of people may not be aware of the historical ties between Israeli apartheid and South African apartheid. And in your book, you quote, I think it's an ambassador saying that there was virtually a love affair between the security apparatus of the Israeli state and the apartheid state in South Africa. Perhaps you could talk about how that relationship developed and the extent to which it was driven by ideology or the extent to which it was driven by other factors.
You know, that relationship I think is so important to understand today, even though obviously apartheid South Africa ended in 1994. And the reason it's important is it was partly a defence relationship. South Africa was desperate for Israeli weapons. And they also wanted uranium, which thank God they didn't get, to build a nuclear bomb that Israel was trying to assist them to get. Let's just hope that that never actually happened. But it was also an ideological alignment, that both nations saw their battles as a fight against barbarism. South Africa saw the fight against black South Africans, Israel saw it as a fight against Palestinians. And they shared each other's ideology. They shared this idea that they're on the front line of this battle for, I mean, they didn't call it white supremacy, but that's essentially what it was, in the late 20th century. And right at the end of South African apartheid in 1994, when the entire world, finally, had turned against South Africa, which country do you think was there right till the end? Yep, Israel.
I was going to say Australia.
Well, yes, Australia was a wonderful friend of South African apartheid too, but we turned against them before Israel, of course we did. And Ariel Sharon, the former Israeli Prime Minister, went to South Africa at various points and often saw what South Africa was doing in so-called Bantustans, these black townships, which were, for those who don't know, kind of quasi self-governed areas, which obviously were essentially controlled by the white minority state. And he loved to do something similar in Palestine, which is exactly what we have today. So they're inspiring each other. And the reason that's relevant today, apart from the obvious, is that, as you rightly say, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty, every single Israeli human rights organization, every single Palestinian human rights organization, call what's happening in Israel and Palestine, not just Palestine, Israel as well, as apartheid. And in the end, the world made a long overdue decision that they were not going to tolerate anymore what South Africa was doing. Put pressure, belt boycotts, sanctions, all those other tools that ended up causing South African apartheid to fold. And I would argue that something similar needs to happen with Israel today. And of course, the hesitation of many people, maybe not in this room, but in general, is the obvious. Not wanting to be seen in some circles as too critical of Israel, not wanting to be seen as too disrespectful towards Israel, not wanting to be seen to be anti-Semitic. And anti-Semitism, of course, has been weaponized against critics of Israel, something which I don't talk about so much in the book, but I've talked about it extensively elsewhere, where anti-Semitism is real and it's worsening, and there's no denying of that. And Jeff and I were just discussing that before we came here. It's real. And I don't feel that much day to day now, but I see it often online, and often people write to me in the hope of, or the thought that they're being supportive of my position, but actually are not a big fan of Jews, which is unacceptable and anti-Semitic. But the problem is, when you, as a supporter of Israel or Israel itself, weaponizes anti-Semitism, which is often what's happening now in many circles as a way to silence critics of Israel, you are delegitimizing real anti-Semitism. You make it impossible to fight the real anti-Semitism, which is real. It exists, both in Melbourne, Sydney, and many places around the world. So the apartheid South Africa-Israel relationship is important for people to remember now. That relationship is not simply in the past. I think the modern equivalent is Israel and India today. India is the world's biggest democracy, self-described, the world's biggest population, surpassing China this year. It is an openly Hindu fundamentalist state that discriminates openly and proudly against roughly 200 million Muslims. And since Modi became Prime Minister in 2014, because traditionally Israel and India were not massively close friends, but that has changed in the modern era, there's been a love affair between Modi and Netanyahu. And the reason that's relevant is that you have Indian officials regularly talking about how much they admire what Israel is doing. They talk about wanting to do something similar in Kashmir to what Israel is doing in the West Bank, namely, in India's case, bringing in huge numbers of Hindus from the main part of India to Muslim-majority Kashmir, similarly to what Israel is doing with Jews, bringing them into Palestinian-majority West Bank. And so it's partly an ideological alignment, also, I think, an admiration of Israel as a state that gets away with it, and ethno-nationalism. And this is one reason also I talked before about why I wrote the book. it's a warning that ethno-nationalism, which is what Israel is, it's an ethno-nationalist state, a proudly Jewish supremacist state, is inspiring other nations and groups around the world. There used to be apartheid South Africa back in the day, but is now countries like India and Hungary, and as I talk about in the book, the global far right. Let me finish on this point, that it's disturbing, and people might be a bit surprised, if you often go to far right rallies, you see, with it's here, the US, Europe, you see the Israeli flag. Now, these are groups that traditionally don't like Jews, are anti-Semitic, are Nazis, but love Israel. Now, why is that? Now, they don't like Jews, but what they love is that Israel is a proudly Jewish supremacist state, and they want to create, in their worldview, a Christian ethno-nationalist state in Australia, the US, Europe, wherever it may be. And I quote in the book Richard Spencer, who's a very unfortunate idiot from the US and so-called alt-right leader, and he calls himself a white Zionist, and I think that's a really relevant and important quote to understand. He doesn't like Jews, but he loves what Israel's doing, because he wants to do something similar in his deluded vision in the US. So the idea that Israel is inspiring people like that, and Israel as a state is not partnering with Richard Spencer, but they are partnering with far-right groups around the world. As someone who's Jewish myself, I mean, I'm non-practicing, but I'm Jewish, the idea that a Jewish state, 75 years after the Holocaust, is partnering with far-right fascists around the world in India and Hungary and elsewhere, it's not just shameful, but deeply worrying. It impacts all of us, Jew or non-Jew.